You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And globally at WPVMFM.org.
Well, howdy, buckaroos and buckarettes.
This is WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. Hello and welcome to A Better World on WPVM. My name is McNair Ezard and I'm your host for today's show. Each week on A Better World, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And our guests today are Patrick Davis and Peter Constantian from Heartfelt Haywood. Patrick Davis is co-founder and president of Heartfelt Haywood, and he's a local hospice chaplain and holistic educator who has worked with several hospices, children's grief centers, and educational programs for training massage therapists and yoga teachers. He collaborates with local grief educators, healthcare professionals, and community volunteers to bring social models of grief and end-of-life care. Peter Constantian is co-founder and executive director at Heartfelt Haywood. He holds a BA in Religion and Economics from St. Olaf College and a Master of Divinity from Duke Divinity School. His experience in leadership comes from years of managing public health and agriculture programs internationally, and as a local pastor for the United Methodist Church in Haywood County. Since 2022, he has served as bereavement coordinator and hospice chaplain for Haywood Hospice and Palliative Care. Peter and Patrick, welcome to A Better World.
Thank you. Looking forward to talking with you.
Absolutely.
So who would like to start off and kind of give us an overview of what Heartfelt Haywood is?
Well, McNair, I'll just give a personal introduction. My name's Patrick, and in partnership with Peter and other board members here in Haywood County, we started offering grief programs for children and adults in partnership with a local foundation, Haywood Health Foundation, and got a lot of referrals from the historic hospice here, Haywood Hospice. And after some time, we started exploring different social models of grief, such as children's grief programs, and also different social models of end-of-life care, such as comfort homes that are being done in neighboring communities. So a group of us started a local nonprofit called Heartfelt Haywood. And after several community meetings, we identified a vision statement. And I'll let Peter declare the vision. It's something we're really proud of, because whenever we share it, someone usually says, yes, I want to be part of that. So I'll let Peter build on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, Heartfelt Haywood was originally brought together as the Haywood End of Life Coalition. We had members from member organizations of churches, end of life organizations like hospice, and just interested community members, people who had experienced grief themselves or loss of a loved one. And our vision, which came out of these community conversations, is to create a community where no one dies alone, no one grieves alone, and caregivers are supported and valued. And so we have these three components of our vision: care for people who are grieving, care for people who are dying, and support for the caregivers that take care of them and are really the bridge, because most people who provide care to a loved one end up needing grief support afterwards.
And I want to ask you about the specific program at Heartfelt Haywood in a bit, but first I'd like to kind of delve a bit more into the situation surrounding the idea for Heartfelt Haywood. It says on the website that you hope to increase our community's resilience in the face of grief and devastating loss. What sorts of issues were you seeing in the community that led to this idea of Heartfelt Haywood?
Well, I'll talk a little bit about my personal experience as a pastor for two rural Methodist churches in Haywood County. In 2021, we experienced a devastating flash flood in Crusoe, North Carolina, caused by Tropical Storm Fred. And at the time, I was caregiver for my partner, Em, who had been diagnosed with chemo, or with cancer rather, and was receiving chemotherapy treatment. She's in remission now. And the flood happened to fall on August 17th, 2021, the same day that she entered remission. So I had this personal experience as a caregiver and very little, actually zero time to really transition from personal caregiving to community caregiving. And what I saw in the wake of that flood, which killed six people in my community, was that there's so much more that we grieve than just the loss of a loved one. Yes, six people died, but the community was irrevocably damaged. I think 750 homes were affected. And it happened that the flood came right at the end of the school day. So luckily, the children were still at school and they were sheltering in place during the storm. If it had come any later, they would have been home and we might have lost children to that flood. But I did notice after the cleanup efforts began that I was hearing from parents and from teachers about how much the flood had affected their students or their children. I remember hearing a story of elementary school teacher who asked her students to draw a picture of what happened during the flood, something that they remembered. And some of the students just drew a picture of the creek near their house or the river, and maybe it was a bit larger, or maybe there were some watermelons floating down. But some of the students drew pictures of their parents holding on to trees for dear life. And hearing stories like that made me realize how much is not being addressed when we bring grief support services just to folks who have lost someone in hospice at the end of life. And it gave me this desire to do more and to create opportunities for people to process grief, no matter what the source, whether it is the loss of a loved one or these environmental disasters that we're experiencing, or just the way that our communities are changing, or the state of the world. There's so much that we grieve that oftentimes we don't have places that we can really work through with supportive community. And that's really the central goal of our grief wing as Heartfelt Haywood, is to provide those spaces.
Did either one of you, have you seen as much in the wake of Hurricane Helene in terms of grief to be attended to?
Actually, once we got one of our first programs for children that we started is called Healing Hearts. We do that four times a year at a stable in Candler. So it's equine assisted grief support. And that's open to children from 5 to 18 years old. And our Healing Hearts program, about a month after Hurricane Helene, we actually had a family, two sons and their mother, participate. The children's father was washed away in the French Broad River. And so we were able to directly respond to the needs that I had seen arising in previous storms by providing this kind of care to children who had experienced devastating loss in the wake of Hurricane Helene. So that felt like a very special moment, sort of coming full circle of, yes, we're actually doing this work now, and we're providing the support that our community needs. And we're just scratching the surface. There's so much more that's needed, but it felt good to know that we were making an impact.
Patrick, any specific like events in your life that led you to want to be involved in grief work and hospice work?
Absolutely. Like, over the years, I've been a hospice chaplain, and I've worked with grief related to someone dying. And then when I lived in Omaha, Nebraska, I was a mental health chaplain where I led support groups for people of all ages. And then a group of people in that community got started a children's grief center. And we followed a model that's been followed nationally through the National Alliance for Children's Grief. And so our founder there had taught us that whenever someone has an adverse childhood event, they're at greater risk. So it was beautiful to have my day job be working with people in a mental health center, leading support groups, and then start this Children's Grief Center Emerge to help children process all types of grief, Yes, maybe the death of a loved one, maybe a divorce, maybe any adverse event in your childhood. And since that was started 30 years ago, it's really been one of the bright spots in my life to go back and honor the founder of that Children's Grief Center in Omaha, Nebraska, and see now those children be 30 years older and be adults who are volunteering and help staff this Children's Grief Center. So Peter talked about it as one of the wings of our movement. And when I moved here, that was a seed I planted. I knew that responding to children's grief was a proactive way to address mental health needs down the road. And because of Peter and Sarah and Molly, people who run our equine program and other creative approaches, we've just started developing a social model here in Haywood County and even in neighboring counties where people can gather and offer education and facilitation for grieving children. So my personal experience was having seen another hospice community do this well in another state. And I was so grateful to meet Peter, who really brought it local and grounded it in the needs here, along with other people on our board of directors. And it's been a joy to bring that seed and see it get sprouted here the past few years.
Was the program in Omaha, was that the Collective for Hope that I saw about you?
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, they started with a cute little name that was just for children called Ted E. Bear Hollow. And after a few years of doing that, they rebranded because the teenagers didn't find that a really cute name. So to this day, that center, 30 years later, has programs for children they call Teddy Bear Hollow, programs for teens. And we have a emerging partnership with them because, as you may know, the nonprofit community is very generous. So they even have a real specialized program to help parents respond to a loss of an infant loss. So part of what our joy is even though this is a new nonprofit for Haywood County, this model of responding to grief by giving people social support skills has been going around the country for decades, starting with the Dougie Center in Portland and the center that I worked with years ago in Omaha, Nebraska. So we're really happy to do our own local version of how do you support people to make sure that when they're grieving, they don't need to be alone.
Mm-hmm. In my experience, and depending on the organization I worked with, it's sometimes been difficult to convince people of the benefits of engaging in grief work. A lot of people want to do it on their own or just don't want to dredge up the bad memories and think they're perhaps prolonging the grief. And I was wondering if both of you could talk about that. Is that true in your experience, or is that an anomaly?
I think that's what's beautiful about grief programs is their focus is social support. So for example, one of the adult programs that we do in partnership with Haywood Hospice is there's this beautiful cafe in Haywood County called the Coffee Cup. And I was sitting there one day, and we used to do a monthly grief support group for adults in conference rooms. And we just partnered with the Coffee Cup Cafe. And now the second Wednesday of every month at 3:30, they close at 3. And 30 people gather around these tables to do like a grief cafe. And so because it's not the intensity of sitting down with a therapist one-on-one, that people feel welcomed at the door. They feel like they can sit down and have a cup of coffee. And they also feel safe just to listen. So one of the beautiful things about grief centers is they're trying to change the therapeutic model from one-on-one conversation to casual support. Or like the children's holiday program that we got funded by WNC Bridge, where Molly and Sarah, our children's grief experts, created a beautiful program where children walked around the room and made ornaments with their hands and sat down with the adults. And then we did a little candle lighting ritual at the end. So one of the reasons grief centers are popping up is you're right. No one thinks it's a good time to go and talk about their grief. And what happens in our programs is people make a social connection. When you look at the Healing Hearts program that Peter talked about that we do in partnership with the equine camp, kids love horses, love being outside. Mm-hmm. And then the beautiful outgrowth of that is the parents think they're dropping the kids off to get support. The parents sit in a circle by the creek, and then the parents do their own work. But you're right. If we had said, hey, you want to spend a Saturday afternoon talking about grief, the parents probably wouldn't show up. But if we say, hey, do you want to show up Saturday afternoon and have your kids interact with other grieving children in a social context, people tend to show up and connect in the joyous ways that you can when you know you're not alone and you're with fellow mm-hmm. people who are grieving. We talk a lot about life and memories, and we laugh and we cry. And so the beautiful thing about this is the social support aspect is people invite people to the Coffee Cup Cafe if they're an adult, to the equine camps if they're children. And Coffee Cup Cafe grew from 4 people to now 30 people. And it's all because of the social support and the welcoming atmosphere made by the peer support, not there being a therapist, you know, educating or talking to people. It's more about coming together in community.
Do you find the frequency of that is sufficient, or do you think it can go to more frequent and people might benefit?
That's exactly the reason we started a nonprofit, because the only reason it was once a month is hospices are required to do a monthly support group. So we started a second gathering for evening people. So we have gotten a lot of feedback saying, even though hospice is required to do once a month, what about another time of the day? And so a lot of the needs we've been assessing, what are other avenues for doing grief support? And Peter has been partnering as our first executive director with the different nonprofit causes in our community and say, hey, what are the needs, including a partnership with the school system where school counselors are going to start working with us and making referrals and helping us bring some of the skill building into the classroom in partnership with them.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Patrick Davis and Peter Constantian. They are from Heartfelt Haywood in Haywood County, North Carolina. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. Okay, that's Peter White playing Long Ride Home from his album Caravan of Dreams. And today on A Better World, we are talking to Peter Constantian and Patrick Davis from Heartfelt Haywood. Before the show, we were talking a little bit about spiritual inclinations and spiritual interest. Can you talk about your spiritual interests and how that may or may not act as a foundation for the work you do with grief?
Well, McNair, I am in the process of being ordained as a United Methodist pastor. I was raised in the United Methodist Church, but I spent a good time away from the church in my earlier days and still continue to resonate deeply with friends of mine who have left the church. I think a lot of young people in my generation have just not been able to connect to the message that's been coming from church and have had questions that have gone unanswered about the rituals there and the meaning behind the words. And I really feel for those folks, and I identify with them deeply. But I eventually did come back to church and had an opportunity to go to divinity school and was invited to consider becoming a pastor. I was not at all certain that that was what I wanted to do with my life, but I gave it a shot. And part of the reason I did is because I had good mentors who were doing excellent work in the community. And also because I really believe in the core mission of the United Methodist Church, which is to make disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world. And in that mission, I think I'm very committed to especially the second half. I think within the church context, it's important to work to make disciples. But Heartfelt Haywood is not a religious organization. And as co-founder, like, I was intentional about that because I want our grief support work, our caregiver support work, to be open and available to everyone, regardless of faith tradition or no tradition. But as far as the transformation of the world is concerned, that's a big goal. But what I've seen through our monthly grief gatherings, I've seen that when people have the support they need to grieve well, meaning that they have time in solitude to reflect, they have learned the skills to demonstrate self-compassion and warmth, towards themselves instead of shitting on themselves, saying, oh, I should be getting better, or this shouldn't be causing me so much pain, but instead can say, I'm feeling sad today. I'm going to cry for 5 minutes, and then I'm going to go find something beautiful to do. And then third, that they find people that they can share that experience with, trusted friends or family or people that they meet in community who they can share that experience with. What I've seen is that when people have those three components, they enter into this sacred opportunity for self-reflection in which there's real possibility for transformation, for changing their whole life. Oftentimes, people who are experiencing some sort of devastating loss, it's enough to wake them up to things that they've needed to change about their lives for a long time, but just have never taken the time to look at. And grief gives us that time, forces us to have that time. It slows us down to such an extent that we take a look in the mirror and at our lives, and we decide, maybe I want to do something different. Now that I know that we don't have that much time left and that every moment is precious, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? And so I've seen the way through grief work, people transform. And honestly, I'm hooked. I love being a part of that transition, that journey that people enter into in the wake of grief. And I'm just so amazed and impressed by how they emerge from the experience when they have the support they need in order to wrestle with difficult questions and come away as a new and better version of themselves.
Yeah, Patrick, what about you? Your spiritual interests as a foundation for your work?
You know, I remember I was like in fourth grade when I overheard my mom, we were raised Catholic, and my brother, who had left home to become Protestant, arguing. And I was so distressed in my little brain, I ran up to my bedroom and threw my head underneath the pillow and cried and said, it's all the same, it's all the same. So I had a very loving experience of a youth movement in my faith tradition that really nurtured me beyond my family of origin. And I went to a faith-based college, and I did work with a wonderful program sponsored by the Jesuits, the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. And then I saw for myself all the ways that spirituality is the same at the mystical core. So if I had to be put in a box, I probably would be if people academically wanted to put me in a box, I don't like that. I'd be a Sufi, because I've loved worshiping in all different arenas. My calling as a hospice chaplain has had me be with someone at the bedside, no matter what their label is, with zero need to proselytize or change their path. And so I feel like every month that I meet someone who's dying, I'm learning something new about the mystery of life. And I concur with everything that Peter says, like the death journey is what brought me into grief. And now that we have our own grief center, meeting people when they're grieving rather than necessarily in the hospice context has been equally transformational. As long as we see every human heart and spirit as having their own answers and that we're there to walk with people. So for me, I'm very motivated by my own spiritual call. And I learn every time I meet with someone, no matter what their language or discourse community is, I feel like that fourth grader in me that wanted to say it's all the same at age eight, is I'm seeing those common denominators that Peter identified, that people feel put back together in a sense of wholeness when they connect with their own heart, which grief forces us to do, when they connect with nature, when they connect with others. So I feel a lot of what we're doing is forming community, which is the value behind all great faith traditions. And I particularly love it because I've learned just as much from atheists and agnostics and Buddhists and Hindus and people who just point to their heart and say, I don't have a label, but it's in here. And I think that's really the beauty of what we're stepping into when we convene people, is we're sharing stories. We're doing the skill building that Peter talked to about. Like, my master's in adult education, so even though I stumbled upon ministry, I'm not an ordained minister within any one particular tradition. I look at what I'm doing as skill building. Can you be in touch with your body? Can you be in touch with your emotions? And as we all know, just because you use a religious label doesn't mean you're whole and complete or you've acknowledged your true feelings. So I love being a companion with people. And the fact that those of us doing this work as grief educators and facilitators, we're doing the work with people. It's like we're working on ourselves full time. We're not therapizing or fixing people. We're just creating arenas where people can gather and be present. And when people leave these gatherings, they're usually smiling. So that feels really good to my heart to know that people know they're not alone and they feel better even though they're grieving.
When you talk about feeling better or talk about healing in regards to loss, is there an end point? I mean, is getting over loss, do you ever get over loss, or is it more being able to, what's the word, like, I guess, integrate it into one's life? I mean, do you call that healing?
I think I'll let Peter speak into that as well. I think what you just said is the key. It's like when I went through my own loss, where I went through a divorce and my mom and dad dying all within 1 year, I didn't know what I was crying about every day, but I did have a sense that the loss was so big. It was this big circle of my life. Like every minute I was sad. And then through a lot of effort and a lot of grace and a lot of support, my life became bigger, but the loss is still within my life. And so I think if you just look at it from the neuroscience perspective, our brains need to be connected to something bigger than us, whether you call it nature or higher power, or the lived experience of being in community, where you don't have to talk about it. You go like, wow, I'm going to be okay. I like to tell a story about a children's grief center we started in Omaha, where these two little girls were in a circle, and all the facilitators did was say, introduce yourself. And this little girl turned another little girl and said, hey, your mommy died, my mommy died. And she held her hand, and they skipped off and had a piece of pizza later during part of this kids' camp. So for me, you're right. Whether your mom died when you were 7 years old, you're going to revisit that loss developmentally when you're a high schooler and your mom can't send you off to prom. You're going to revisit that loss when you go to college. So our hope is, if you've known love, the pain of that loss never leaves you because you know love. And so I think the word you use about integration is what I use. I talk about the three eyes of grief. You have to feel the impact. You also have to hold it with moments of illumination and joy, which is why we need fellowship and community and nature and dancing and creative arts. And then your own body at some point does integrate the loss so that your life gradually becomes bigger. And for me, I don't know when that happens. I feel like it is like a spiritual experience. It's either very gradual, or some people report a moment when it happened. Like, I know for me, it was like 18 months of grieving full time before my life was bigger than those three losses happening right in a row, the divorce, mom dying, dad dying. And I think it is a process of integration that you just spoke to.
Peter, any thoughts about what healing looks like?
Yeah, I think I agree with Patrick that the losses are never sort of erased from our memory or our spirit. We certainly will carry them with us. I've heard someone say that we don't get over a loss, but we move through it. And I've seen the way people, when they have been with us for a while, processing their grief in community, just can carry it better because they know that they've got people who can share the load. Right away, when we lose someone and the pain is so deep and so heavy, it can feel impossible to move. But that's where I see the benefit of being able to share our experience with others. And people who come to our grief gatherings for the first time after a loss oftentimes can't even find the words to say anything without bursting into tears. And that's okay. And that's, I think, an absolutely necessary part of the journey. And yet I see people come back every month, and it gets a little easier and a little easier and a little easier as they find ways to open up about what they're experiencing, and that sharing is met not with judgment or people jumping in to try to fix the situation for them or provide solutions, but instead just listening, holding it, accepting it, not judging, but participating with sharing that pain. And I think that's the best we can do.
Have you noticed any kind of time frame for people, say, who I know Patrick had mentioned 18 months and he started kind of coming back into his own, but between people who've lost a loved one, say through natural causes, like an illness or disease or something, and people that have gone through a catastrophic event like Hurricane Fred or Hurricane Helene, is there a difference in the time frame between when people can start feeling back to normal or like they're integrating the grief into their lives?
Well, I think honestly, it's very particular. It's very specific to the person. And even with all of the support that we could provide or that they could receive from their family or community, there's no telling how long it will take someone to process to where they feel like they can carry it on their own. I've studied several languages, and I know the feeling of being immersed in a new language and just how exhausted the mind is, even after half a day of trying to think in another language, listen in another language, respond in another language. Mm-hmm. Because when we're learning a new language, we're trying to do all the things that we would otherwise do, but then we have this secondary process going on. And grief is a lot like that. Our lives don't slow down because of a loss that we've experienced. But even as we go through the motions of our daily lives, going to work, going to church, going to school, doing chores, running errands, we have this secondary process of grieving and of missing someone going on, which is why people obviously feel exhausted in the early days of grief. But I do think that when we have the structure of community support, that's something that we can consistently return to, that we can share our stories with, I do see the progression happen a lot faster. As bereavement counselor for Haywood Hospice, I would do calls all the time to people who had just lost someone, make a call within the first 7 to 14 days to everyone who had lost somebody on hospice. And I would also get referrals from doctor's offices for people who were struggling with grief after months. And what I recognized is that people who were referred to me by their doctors who were concerned that they were developing PTSD symptoms from the loss that they had experienced, the common strain was that they hadn't told anyone about what they'd gone through.
So is that kind of what might contribute to to this idea of someone getting stuck in their grief process?
I think absolutely. I remember one woman in particular, she had seen her husband die in a pretty traumatic way. He had fallen down the stairs to his death. And she felt like she didn't want to share that awful memory with her friends or her family. She didn't want to burden them with it. Mm-hmm. But what that meant is that she was carrying it herself. And it just got worse and worse. There was no relief for her. And so through conversations with her, we identified one friend that maybe she could tell this story to, who wouldn't run away, who would actually sit and listen. And that was the start of her healing, was reaching out to that one friend and telling the story. And it just gets lighter with each person we share it with.
So Patrick, is there, like, for people that want to help somebody that's grieving, are there any kind of suggestions you can give how they might be supportive? Is it just a matter of being present and being willing to listen?
Yes, it is a matter of being present and listening. I've done this off and on for 30 years for 6 different hospices and a few different grief centers. And what I've noticed that sticks, that stays with people, like when they call me back a year later and they say, "You shared something with me that was really helpful." I'm like, "Well, what did I say?" And one of the most important, the only theory I bring into the grief work I do is called the dual process. And I build on some work of a mentor of mine who said when her husband died, even though she had all this grief theory because she was a national grief author, Joy Johnson, she said, "Every day I sat in front of a picture of my husband, Marv, and I let myself have an unhappy time and I cried for 5 minutes. And then every day I went outside and did something with my grandkids or had tea with a friend." And so what I found myself saying, if I'm authentically present with you, And McNair, if you were right now processing something, and in the conversation, you both laughed about what you loved about your loved one, and you also cried, I often will say, I'm not worried about you because you're both laughing and crying. And that's the dual process. As long as, to your earlier point about timelines and processes, if we have the capacity to do both every day, I think gradually our hearts expand and grow through that. So I will give people suggestions. I'll say, be the person in someone's life where they can both laugh and cry. And, you know, be the person in their life that will bring them food, that will comfort them and say, hey, do you want to go dancing or do you want to go for a hike? And also be the person where they can just cry and there's nothing you're trying to do with the tears or fix or figure out. Because most people treat grief as an illness to fix and medicate or get rid of. And grief on its own is not a mental illness. We may all come from traumatized families and have depression, anxiety, and that's a different arena. And if we're grieving, we just need arenas to go to where people will listen to us and hold it and know that it's okay. And also we need arenas to go to where people will let us celebrate life and laugh and have fun. So that's the main thing I say to people is be the person in someone's life where they can both laugh and cry. And acknowledge someone's strength that they're able to do that.
You're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. And our guests today are Peter Constantian and Patrick Davis from Heartfelt Haywood. And we'll return with them in just a couple of minutes after this break.
It's been a long day without you, my friend, and I'll tell you all about it when I see you again. We've come a long way from where we began. Oh, I'll tell you all about it when I see you again, when I see you. Why'd you have to leave so soon, yeah? Why'd you have to go? Why'd you have to leave me when I needed you the most? Cause I don't really know how to tell you without feeling much worse. I know you're in a better place, but it's always gonna hurt. Carry on. It's been a long day without you, my friend.
Okay, welcome back. That's Charlie Puth singing See You Again. And today on A Better World, we're talking to Patrick Davis and Peter Constantian from Heartfelt Haywood. Kind of in the second half of the show, but I want to make sure we talk about the programs at Heartfelt Haywood, and if we could please. And you mentioned earlier about the equine therapy program, and I wanted to kind of start off this segment of the show with that. What is it about horses that are good for people in grief?
Well, if our friend and vice president of our board, Sarah Tamaka, was here, who really founded that program, she would say horses are magical. And being with a creature of that size who is also just so tender and available is a really powerful experience. And what I've seen is that these horses have all kinds of personalities. And for folks who haven't spent a lot of time around horses, that might be difficult to imagine. But just like us, they have personalities and they don't communicate with words. And for somebody who's grieving, who maybe hasn't found the words to explain or express how they're feeling, it can be really comforting to be with somebody, with a creature who doesn't need them to speak in words, who doesn't need them to listen or process in language. I remember reading about a survey that was done by Dr. Joanne Cacciatore it felt like kind of a damning survey for us as hospice chaplains, because participants in her survey ranked who were the most helpful connections for them in grief. And at the top of the list, it was animals, horses, dogs, cats, these creatures that have become companions to us that we don't have to have answers for. We don't have to explain ourselves to. And that's what the equine program does. It provides that space. And if we can start to perceive the personality traits of a horse that we're with, or a dog, if we can sense to some extent when they might be sad or anxious or nervous or happy, I think it gives us a way to reflect on our own emotional experience, because we're so often separating mind from body, but really our emotions are held in our bodies. And being able to see that in another creature, I think, gives us the permission to see it in ourselves too. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, the magic of being with these horses.
How do children get connected with that program?
Well, the Healing Hearts program is 4 times a year. And anybody who is interested or knows of a child who's experienced recent grief can find information about the program on our website, heartfelthaywood.org. And just click events and you'll scroll down and you'll find it. And there's a registration link. These will be ongoing. We do try to keep registration limited because it is a very intimate experience. So registration is open for 12 children.
Do children, can they take it more than once, or is it one time and they're finished?
No, absolutely. They're welcome to participate again. We've had some who have come to almost every program. Once being involved, a young boy whose mother died of cancer has participated with his father for, I think, 4 out of 5 programs, and has really bonded with the horses, but also become a mentor to the new children who are participating in the program, because his comfort level with the experience has been established. So he's able to support other children and sort of guide them through something that's familiar now.
Yeah, it sounds like a wonderful program. I would imagine the adults benefit from it as well, don't they?
Absolutely. Patrick mentioned that we do have a support circle for the parents while the kids start off with the horses. And bringing the parents together, they have that commonality of supporting a child who's grieving. And also usually that means they're grieving too, whether the child lost a parent who is a spouse to this person or a grandparent who is a parent to this person. The time of sharing that the adults go through is really meaningful and connecting, because they have this commonality. And so we try to help them process as well, not only in how to support their child, but also how to care for themselves in the midst of it.
Patrick, can you talk about how loss for children might differ from loss that adults experience?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'll back into that a couple of ways. One is, we're speaking a lot about the children's grief component. And equally important is, we have these creative healing programs for adults where they make jewelry and visual arts. So I will say this, whether you're chronologically a child or you're an adult, our inner child needs to use our bodies more and be concrete. So one of the beautiful things developmentally that children are different is, they don't get lost in the pretense. So when parents are asking me how to guide their children, I'll say, listen to them, sit down with them, hold them, and let them lead the way, answer their questions. And it's really adults that, I mean, just when you're talking about death, for example, we're the ones that use vague metaphors like, mom's in a better place. Whereas developmentally, any child educator will say, be concrete, just like you would with a pet who died, the body stopped breathing. And then the kid goes, well, what are we going to do with the body? Like, well, why don't we put some flowers around and dig a hole in the yard and bury our pet cat? Or a lot of families are now being empowered with, when you look at things like in our neighboring community, the Center for Conscious Living and Dying, there's a lot of people who say, wow, how do we bring death rituals back into the home and or involve kids? So back when I did the Children's Grief Center in Omaha, just for kids and families to know, they had the option of putting a teddy bear or flowers in the casket, or if they were doing, you know, ashes, they had the freedom to incorporate death rituals. So there's something about using the body that kids really get. I know when my parents died, grandparents to my nieces and nephews, we did all these fancy rituals because we're Catholic, the Catholic mass, the funeral. And when you talk to these kids now, what they remember is something that we did that was unplanned. We went to the cemetery after both deaths. My mom died October 20th. My dad died October 29th. And we just spontaneously started picking up the dirt with our hands and putting it on the casket. So when my sister now talks to her kids and she goes over it, as soon as she brings up putting dirt on the casket, they go, "Oh, I remember that, Grandma." So I feel like I say let kids lead the way with our grief, because if you slow down, put a kid on your lap, and there's a lot of good educational books if you want to be offer a little bit more guidance that talk about death in a concrete way that help you as a parent. Just connect with the kids, slow down, and let their questions lead the way, because ironically, they're helping us more than we're helping them, or it's mutual. Because all kids need is to know they're loved no matter what, that this is the truth of life, whether it's our goldfish, our pet, or our grandma, or our mom who died, and we are going to get through this together. So kids are just wanting our connection, because they're the ones that cry for 5 minutes and go, "Okay, I want to go have a piece of pizza." So that resilience of kids, where they can laugh one moment and cry the next, that's the dual process that we as adults have to plan and become awakened to again, because kids do it naturally. So as long as we don't burden kids with our weird metaphors and our vagueness, and we're really concrete with them and tell them the way it is and answer their questions and let them know they're loved no matter what, and surround them with community, and as appropriate, involve the teachers and the counselors, and by all means, therapists. They just need safe places to know that they can ask any questions and talk about their feelings with anybody that will listen.
Today on A Better World, we are talking to Patrick Davis and Peter Constantian from Heartfelt Haywood. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. Okay, that's Paul Hillier and Hillier Ensemble singing "Weep, O Mine Eyes." And today we are talking to Patrick Davis and Peter Constantian from Heartfelt Haywood. So let me ask you about another program you have. I think earlier in the show you mentioned it just briefly about the Grief Book Circle. Is that different from the monthly group at the coffee place?
Yes. Yes, the Grief Book Circle emerged out of the monthly grief gathering at the Coffee Cup Cafe, because as we've identified, sometimes people need more support than a once-a-month program. So we invited folks to read a book about grief with us, and Leanne Mertens, who's the volunteer manager at Haywood Hospice, and I co-facilitated that group for the first year. Now it's co-facilitated by Leanne and one of our volunteers. And what we see in that process is that we have this book, which gives us something to talk about. But really, to call it a book group, I think might be misleading. It's not really all about the book. In the range between group therapy and book club, our grief book circle is somewhere in the middle. So the book is helpful to generate questions and to invite us into conversation. But really what we're trying to do in this group is identify a common language, a common vocabulary for talking about our own loss. And so we've done that with several books. I mentioned Dr. Joanne Cacciatore. She writes a book called Bearing the Unbearable. That was the first book we started with. We read Frances Weller's The Wild Edge of Sorrow, which we had to go back and do again just because it was so in-depth that we wanted to spend more time with it. And right now, the group is reading a book by Megan Devine called It's Okay That You're Not Okay. And we plan to do that book every year on a cycle, but we'll bring more books into the mix. But that's a small group that is not closed per se, because people are welcome to join at any time, but does provide a more intimate space where there's really a deeper level of sharing that's going on.
Is that a monthly group as well?
It's a weekly group, actually. Mm-hmm. That group meets Thursdays at 5 p.m. in the basement of Grace Church in the Mountains in Waynesville.
So are there any other programs that we haven't touched on or that are in process now, or are you coming up in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what we've talked about so far would all fit into like the first phase of our development as a nonprofit organization, which is really grief support for adults and children. Our three phases are bringing us in the direction of providing community care at the end of life. And so the second phase is to integrate not just grief support, but also support for people who are actively caregiving for someone who's dying. And so with a woman who recently lost her own husband on hospice, we've started a bi-weekly caregiver support program in Maggie Valley. Meets at the Organic Beans coffee shop on Soco Road every other Monday. And we're also doing some community death education work. And so that can seem like a real downer, but it's actually a lot of fun. We have a monthly movie night where we showcase a foreign film that touches on the themes of grief and loss and caregiving with food and discussion. And oftentimes these become really deep and meaningful conversations where we get to talk about things that don't really come up around the dinner table all that often. And that I think a lot of people have a longing for, whether we realize it or not. We talk about these bigger questions. And we're partnering with other local organizations to offer things like mindful mood movement, where people can engage with the emotions of grief through moving their body. We're partnering with the Pollinators Foundation to do that. We have three creative healing events throughout the year, which are a half day or a full day workshop with a jeweler or with a visual artist. And those are just different ways that people can connect with their grief or their experience as a caregiver to express that in a way that doesn't necessarily involve talking about it. Because sometimes, you know, that modality of just talking about our feelings isn't enough to really connect with our embodied experience, at least not for everyone.
Let me, since we're getting close to the end of the show, let me start with Patrick and ask you, has being with people who are dying and grieving changed your perspective on life?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's constant. Like, it keeps me awake to what's important. Like, every time I walk with someone, I try to stay fresh and learn something new. And one of the cutting-edge things it's teaching me right now is how to care for myself better. Like, you know, Peter talked about the fact that our grief programs are currently funded. So that's what we're talking about today. And this whole initiative we want to do around care for the caregiver. And then ultimately, we want to have community homes for the dying. And we'll come back and talk about that someday when we're about to mm-hmm. launch that. But I'm seeing that the more I do this work, the more I have to authentically also, you know, practice what you teach. I have to slow down. I have to have a daily quiet time. I have to be in nature every day. I need to take care of myself. Because if I don't do that, I start getting kind of burned out and crusty, and I'm not present. I've always felt like deeply privileged and honored to be with people and invited into their homes to hear their life story. when I was in my early 20s and I stumbled upon a training program is because I wanted to play my guitar for kids in the hospital. And I wasn't a music therapist. I only know three or four chords. And they go, well, you've been a youth minister and you work with the Jesuits. Why don't you apply to this residency to be a chaplain? And I just happened to luck out. There was a funded residency for my faith tradition. And I was paid full-time to study called clinical pastoral education. So they put a name badge on me. I was a chaplain all of a sudden. And I remember the first time I went to someone's room in the oncology unit and he saw my name tag chaplain, he started swearing and said, get out of my blankety blank room. I'm an atheist. And then as those of us who work in healthcare know, there's a big difference between a pastor trying to convert you to their religion and a chaplain who's there to be present. So the nurses a day later said, hey, don't be so mean to the chaplains. They're just here to listen to you. They're not going to like make you change your mind about your atheism. And this guy who was in the hospital the week he died got to be a friend. And I remember sitting next to his bed the night before he died. And all he said to me was, Patrick, I've brought kids into the world and grandkids. I have left the world a better place. So for me, I feel like I get to be my original training in college. I'm a first generation college student. It was history. And now my history is personal. Like, there's not a person I've not met that if you're really listening, they have some desire in their heart to make the world a better place.
We can't ask for much more than that on our deathbed, can we?
Well, that's why this work is so meaningful and actually ironically joyous for me. To get to really get to know people deeply is really a privilege and an honor.
Peter, what about for yourself as doing your work? How has it changed your perspective on life?
Well, being with people who are nearing the end and their families, I like to say it keeps me sane, honestly. There's so many, I think, useless conversations that we have throughout the day. And as a chaplain, I've really developed a skill set in listening for cues that someone doesn't want to talk about something meaningful. For example, if they start talking about the weather or the latest game or the news, I try to dig a little deeper than that. And oftentimes, when we do move past those sort of niceties and small talk conversations, we get into these really meaningful conversations about what was my life about. That's the kind of conversations that I live for. That's what keeps me around. Like, I want to be a part of a community where people know that their lives matter and that their lives have been a contribution to the people around them. And the way we get to that is by sharing and by listening to one another and by reflecting to one another the beauty that we each bring to the world. And my experience of sitting with people who are dying, it has saved my life and just reminded me that we don't know how much time we have. We better make the most of it. Do what matters and what is meaningful now. Take the risk, because this is all we've got.
Final question. How can people find out more about Heartfelt Haywood?
Our website is heartfelthaywood.org. That's HEARTFELTHAYWOOD.org. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram.
Well, I look forward to having both of you back on the show sometime to kind of, there's a lot we didn't cover in terms of grief and as your program grows and the availability of programs for people expands, I want to have you back on the show to talk about that. And I'd like to thank Patrick Davis and Peter Constantian from Heartfelt Haywood for coming on the show today. And thank you for the work you do in the community and all the best to you.
Thanks so much, McNair.
Thank you, McNair.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. My name is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with Joe Cocker singing Let the Healing Begin from the album Have a Little Faith.
Carried it around just like a stone. Too heavy for